The Prelude, number one in E minor by Villa-Lobos, played by Narciso Yepes. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you found it interesting, and thank you for listening. Next week, James is back, again, with his own custom-built selection. I'll be listening at home while raiding my own shelves for my next appointment with you, which will be in 2 weeks' time. In the meantime, enjoy your listening, and do join James next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock, here on Radio 3.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
I'm Donald MacLeod, and I've been writing and presenting Radio 3's Composer of the Week since 1999. The programme itself has been going a bit longer than that. This week's composer, as it was originally known, first hit the airwaves on the BBC Home Service 70 years ago. As part of our birthday celebrations this year, we want to put the spotlight on a composer who's never appeared on the programme before. And to do that, we need your suggestions. On the Composer of the Week webpage, you can find a list of all the composers we've ever featured over the last 7 decades. If there's someone you think we've unjustly overlooked, please let us know. You can send an email to composeroftheweek@bbc.co.uk, write us a letter, or tweet us at the hashtag COTW70.
Well, now, on BBC Radio 3, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the astrophysicist, Professor Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell.
As a 24-year-old PhD student, Jocelyn Bell Burnell made a discovery that changed the way we see the universe. She discovered the radio signal for a totally new kind of star, a pulsar. This was a milestone in the history of astrophysics, for which her older male colleagues got the Nobel Prize, her name being unfairly, and in the view of many, outrageously, left off. But many honours have followed, and Jocelyn Bell Burnell became the first woman to be president of the Institute of Physics. She's currently visiting professor of astrophysics at Mansfield College and Oxford University. So, Jocelyn, only 24 when you made that extraordinary discovery. The dense cores of exploded stars, I think, are what pulsars are. Can you describe the excitement of that time and perhaps elucidate on my rather amateurish description?
Your description, Michael, is very good, thank you. It's very accurate. It was exciting, kind of thing that we had never expected to find, and for a long time was quite hard to believe. It was so amazing. But they're real. When you study the cosmos, the big things, there's a risk of jumping too quickly to a conclusion that it's of great cosmic significance, when in fact it's a grotty plug, you know, in the lab next door. So we had to check things out very, very carefully, but it was an outrageous signal. Nobody expected that kind of thing from the stars at all. So that was one reason why we had to check carefully. But as we checked, and it became clearer and clearer that this was something in the cosmos, not in the equipment, something way out in our galaxy, still apparently unique at that stage until I found the subsequent ones, but exciting, amazing, as well as having been very disturbing earlier on.
You've chosen a piece that captures that exhilaration of looking at the heavens through a telescope almost.
Yes, and interestingly, although there isn't any evidence for this, there is a persistent rumour that it was written after Haydn had looked down Herschel's telescope at some stars and galaxies and things, and was so moved he went and wrote this creation with this magnificent choral piece.
And it's a nice touch, because I think Herschel played the oboe himself.
Herschel did many things. He played the organ. He was a conductor, he was a composer, but gave up music to build telescopes and do astronomy.
And so this piece perhaps sums up for you the sheer wonderment of what is out there.
It's a very stirring piece.
The heavens are
That was The Heavens Are Telling the Glory of God, the trio from Haydn's Creation. And we heard Mark Padmore, Sandrine Piao and Neil Davis with Cheetham's Chamber Choir, the Gabrieli Consort and Players, all conducted by Paul McCreesh. I think you discovered a love of astronomy very early on, Jocelyn Bell-Burnell, reading your father's astronomy books.
Right. Yes.
But what about your passion for music? Did that come later in life?
Yes, main passion came later in life. I didn't get on with music very well at school. I'd done ballet as a small girl and loved it. Still loved dancing. But piano pieces and things like that didn't appeal. There were a lot of those in my school days, and I actually decided that music wasn't for me. And it was only much, much later that I came back round to it.
And do concerts form a part of your life? Do you enjoy going to them, feel a need for them, hearing live music?
Yes. I live in a small town in Wiltshire called Bradford-on-Avon, and it has its own music centre, which is about 10 minutes' walk from where I live, with a lovely programme of mainly younger musicians, young quartets, groups like that, who do fantastic work. And it's very well supported, and it's a great resource in a small town.
This next piece, Jocelyn, is important to you, I think, because it takes you back to your childhood in Northern Ireland.
Yes, as I said, I did ballet as a young girl, was quite good at it, really enjoyed it, and of course danced to all sorts of music. I don't think ever to Pineapple Paul, but I like Gilbert and Sullivan just as the music, and this was made into a ballet, which was lovely.
Thank you.
Everyone round here's jiggling in their seats, tapping, conducting. It's the kind of thing that really makes your feet tap, isn't it?
Yes, and it brings to my mind sort of prancing horses at the circus as well.
Yes, you have to be very fit to dance to that.
The opening dance from Arthur Sullivan's Pineapple Poll, arranged for ballet by Charles McCarris, who was conducting the London Philharmonic in that recording. I'm always being asked where you can find details of the recordings, and they are, in fact, on the Private Passions page if you go to the Radio 3 website. Ballet was, of course, the kind of thing you were supposed to do, weren't you, at a girls' school in the 50s, sewing and cooking. But what about science? Was there an opportunity to do that?
I can remember very vividly my first week in secondary school. And on the Wednesday of that first week, a message went round the first year class that afternoon, the girls to such and such a room, the boys to another one. Initially, I thought it was sport, but it wasn't. They sent the boys to the science lab and the girls to the domestic science room. The assumption was that we would learn cookery, needlework, and the boys would do the science. And I was very disappointed because I was expecting to do science at secondary school. When my parents heard that evening, they raised the roof, as did the parents of a few other girls. And when the science class next met, there were, I think, three girls and all the boys. And the teacher made us girls sit right under his nose. But that was my introduction to science, and it was very good. And I discovered I could do science when a lot of people couldn't.
And was there someone who you found particularly inspirational? Because it's so important at that age, isn't it?
Later on, when I moved to a boarding school in England, yes, I had a very good physics teacher, Henry Tillett, who'd come out of retirement for the second time to teach us at this girls' boarding school.
This was a Quaker school, wasn't it?
Yes.
Has that been important to you throughout your life?
Yes. I was born, brought up a Quaker. Moving to England and moving to that boarding school was very good for me. It was a style of Quakerism that suited me very well, much better than back home, and has actually kept me within that faith all my life.
Have you ever been aware of the dilemma that faces Quakers in particular, but indeed all people who feel very strongly about conflict between science and that belief? I mean, for example, the science that gave us the atom bomb, etc., etc.
I don't experience that because Quakerism doesn't set out a list of required tenets. You are expected to work out your own faith, and you are expected to evolve it as you go through life, gain more experience. And that seems to me awfully like being a research scientist, where, again, you evolve your understanding as you do more research, get more data. So for me, the two work very well together. There's not so many ethical areas in astrophysics, I will agree. Although if we make contact, well, no, not make contact, if we discover civilizations elsewhere in the universe, then I think there could be issues which we need to start addressing, because I think it won't be that long before astronomers find evidence of life on planets way out in the galaxy.
Oh, fascinating. We must talk about that again a little bit later on in the programme. Let's have a piece of music that I think takes you back to this boarding school. And it's one that most of us, I think, have done at school. For us, it was an excuse to meet girls.
Yes. Similar with us.
But boys.
But boys, yes. At school, I was involved with the stage crew for productions. I think I was probably stage manager for this one. We did Trial by Jury, which is one of the pieces that Sullivan incorporated into Pineapple Poll, and Dido and Aeneas. And this is Dido's lament. She is about to commit suicide, and she's being quite reflective on what that means. And I find it very powerful for that reason.
Especially as sung here by Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, who died tragically young.
Yes. More I will. rather better than my school production, without being disloyal.
When I am laid in earth, Dido's Lament from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. We heard Lorraine Hunt Lieberson with the Cambridge Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas McGeegan. As a girl who was passionate about physics, I guess you were something of a pioneer at school, and even when you went on to Glasgow University, you encountered a continuation, really, of that sort of sexism, didn't you, that you'd already encountered?
I guess today we would label it sexism and harassment, but in those days we didn't have those words, to be honest. There was a tradition in Glasgow at the time that when a woman entered the lecture theatre, all the guys whistled and stamped and banged the desk and catcalled and, you know, it's just what you did, apparently.
And then when the Nobel Prize was awarded for your discovery of the pulsars in 74, and the older colleagues took the credit, something which, as I said earlier, many scientists have been very annoyed about, did it affect you badly, or did you somehow just take it as par for the course at that time?
I'm a political animal, scientifically political, and I realised immediately what an important precedent this was, because there wasn't a Nobel Prize for astronomy, and the physics community had recognised the work of astronomers and how important these stars were. So that was primarily my reaction. Created a precedent that's been followed by other astronomers. So that was the overwhelming feeling. It was also a difficult time in my career where I was trying to combine family and work. So there were complications there, but it was significant for the precedent.
I'm sure you're absolutely right, because actually bitterness is never a very productive quality or feeling, is it?
It's a waste of energy, isn't it? Yes.
You mentioned your Quaker belief earlier, and this next piece is as a result of a visit to churches in the Soviet Union before the fall of communism, in fact.
Yes, that's right. I was one of an ecumenical group going on a visit to the Soviet churches. Very interesting in itself. We mainly visited the Russian Orthodox Church and spent a lot of time listening to Russian Orthodox liturgy, which is sung by wonderful singers and wonderful choirs.
Marvellous basses.
Fantastic basses. You know, to be a priest in the Orthodox Church, you have to audition. Nothing else matters. And having been turned off music by a lot of piano concerts in my teenage years, I was suddenly grabbed by this choral tradition in the Russian Orthodox Church. Really grabbed by it. And that's what brought me back to music.
Thank you.
There is a great feeling of awe about that music, don't you think? Music from the Rachmaninov Vespers, the all-night vigil. We heard the Corydon Singers conducted by Matthew Best. It seems to me that silence is a very undervalued commodity, actually in music and maybe even in science.
And on the radio.
that space between words, that space between phrases of music is kind of magical.
I was at a concert in Oxford at the weekend, the Oxford Bach Choir, which is superb. And I noticed that the conductor and the orchestra stood stock still for a minute or so at the end of each piece, preventing applause, in a sense, because you kind of need that digestion time.
Is there silence in the cosmos, or is it a very noisy place?
No, it's extremely silent, because you need some air to carry the sound waves. All this stuff about asteroids going whoosh through the universe is filmmaker's license. There's no whoosh.
This is a very appropriate subject for us to be discussing, given the nature of this next piece, stunningly beautiful piece, The Cantus in Memory of Benjamin Britten by Arvo Pärt. After three beats of silence that open the score, there's a tubular bell, isn't there, which is struck three times, pianissimo.
Yes.
And it tells of the death of Britten. I remember when I first heard this at the Proms. In fact, I think I was introducing the concert, and I was completely gobsmacked by it.
Yeah, yes. I first heard it in the Wiltshire Music Centre about 10 years ago. I'd known other pieces of Pärt's work, but not this.
Thank you. It's extraordinary how simply a downward scale can be, if used beautifully, so telling.
And the tubular bells kind of punctuating it in a lovely way.
You know, Peart, it's interesting, Peart was an extreme modernist at one point, and he got disillusioned, and he just threw it all away and went back studying very early music. And this was one of the first products of that rethinking about music. We heard the Cantus in Memory of Benjamin Britten, composed by Arvo Peart, and played there by the Bergen Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Nema Järvi. You've, like most people, experienced great difficulties in your life, haven't you? Challenges of a son who was very ill as a child, and a marriage that went wrong.
Yes. I think probably no more or no less than other people. But we are often encouraged to put grief and woundedness aside too quickly, I think. And there are some things that don't heal.
When you were at home in Lurgan, and this is another aspect of grief, it's not just what happens to you, but your worry about other people, isn't it?
Yes. Singularly bad timing. I went away to boarding school in England just at the point that the troubles restarted in Northern Ireland. And I think there was editorial policy amongst the British-English newspapers not to report that too much. And so you'd get snippets of information. The most traumatic of which I remember was the item of news that the mayor of Lurgan had been shot. And I knew him, Alec Greer. And of course, it didn't make clear whether he'd been shot and killed or shot and wounded. You know, so you're living in a kind of agony until you get a letter from home that fills it out for you.
And fact, which was it in the end?
Shot and wounded. And he made a good recovery. But, you know, it's difficult stuff to live with. And I really take my hat off both to the Northern Irish politicians who stepped away from their party lines and started talking, and also, I think, to the women who facilitated a lot.
For me, this next piece of music, Verdi's famous chorus of the Hebrew slaves from Nabucco, always has the quality of prisoners coming into the light somehow. There's a kind of feeling of hope and relief and rejoicing.
Interestingly, I don't hear that in this piece. I hear the Hebrews in slavery, homesick, unable to sing the song they're required to sing because they are in Babylon, not back home, in grief rather than in triumph. And it appeals to me because of the way Verdi deals with grief. You know, grief comes in waves. You're homesick for a bit, you get better. You're homesick again, there's another wave of it, you feel better. It comes back round at you several times, be it homesickness or bereavement. A wonderfully controlled piece that sometimes it can be rip-roaring, can't it?
It was beautifully conducted there by Giuseppe Sinopoli. The chorus of the Hebrew Slaves from Verdi's Nabucco, the choir and orchestra of Deutsche Oper Berlin, conducted, as I said, by Giuseppe Sinopoli. I gather you're rather good with a sledgehammer, Jocelyn Belbonel.
When I was studying for my PhD, my doctorate in Cambridge, spent the first 2 years building a radio telescope, hammering posts into the ground, stringing cables up between them and so on. Acquired all sorts of curious techniques during that phase. And yes, sledgehammering was one of them.
And you love gardening and being in the country at weekends, don't you?
Yes, although I don't sledgehammer in the garden, I hasten to add.
But I can't resist, before we hear the next piece, which very much represents this idyll, if you like, picking you up on something you said rather provocatively earlier on, the fact that you feel we may well discover life on other planets.
Yeah, one of the amazing and exciting things in astronomy at the moment is that we're finding planets round other stars, lots of them, far, far more than we expected. Approximately one planet for every star there is up in the sky that we can see. And so the question arises, well, are any of those inhabited? Or do any of those support any kind of life? And the chances are that, yes, some do. And the chances are, I judge, that within the next 100 years, we're going to find which of them support life. Now, it may be very primitive life.
Or it might indeed be two people there this very minute in a studio discussing music like you and me.
Yes, and broadcasting the radio waves across space as well as to all their listeners, ready to be picked up by other planets.
Fascinating stuff. Well, let's let you go to your rural retreat in the country, because this music by Smetana really takes you there. Tell me what it is in the music that you feel suggests this idea of a rural idyll.
Well, as I understand that this particular piece is tracing the course of a river.
Filtova.
Right from source, where it's a bright, sparkly, springy thing, down to its lower reaches where it's sombre and stately. And I find it very evocative. You can picture it. And I like that. It's sheer escapism, but I like it.
Well, it's a nationalistic piece now almost too. It's Smetana's Marvlast. And this movement, as you say, is Viltava.
Thank you.
Smetana's evocation of the beauty of his fatherland, Vltava, from the cycle of symphonic poems My Country, Ma Vlast, played by the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Václav Smetáček. As an astrophysicist, are you still inspired by the sheer beauty of the night sky?
Yes, when I take the trouble to look at it. In the course of a job, one doesn't look at it very much. But where I live in Wiltshire, it's wonderfully dark and you can see a lot of the night sky. So, you know, each time I climb out of the car, I glance up and it's beautiful.
I think you edited a book of poetry inspired by astronomy. And I wonder, what's your favourite poetic description of the stars?
I think my favourite poem is the one that started it all. A bit like music, I didn't get on with poetry at school. We got told to write a poem about a daisy for homework for tomorrow, and that just didn't work, so I decided poetry wasn't for me. And much later in life, I was talking about the size of the universe, how long it takes light to cross it, and a friend said to me, "Do you know Delay by Elizabeth Jennings? Would you like to see it?"
I'd like to see it. I'll share it.
Thank
with
you.
Our audience. The radiance of that star that leans on me was shining years ago. The light that now glitters up there, my eye may never see, and so the time lag teases me with how love that loves now may not reach me until its first desire is spent. The star's impulse must wait for eyes to claim it beautiful, and love arrived may find us somewhere else. Delay, that was by Elizabeth Jennings.
I use that poem in a number of my public lectures and other poems. That one's nice because it talks, as you say, about the time lag between starlight setting off and starlight reaching us. But I think it also appealed to me because at that time I was going through divorce. And there is also this sense of dislocation in the poem. Love arrived may find us somewhere else. So for those reasons, it speaks to me.
Your last piece, Jocelyn, is for fellow astronomers and I think future astronomers. And it's by Sibelius. It's incidental music from Pelléas et Molisande.
It's the introduction, the theme music that has been used for years and years and years for The Sky at Night, the television programme. I believe it was originally Patrick Moore's choice of introductory music, and it has remained, even though Patrick Moore, alas, is no longer with us.
You knew him quite well.
Like a number of astronomers, I had the chance to appear on his programme from time to time. And so, yeah, I think a number of us, as we hear this music, will find the muscles in our stomach contorting. Because appearing on that programme was quite a roller coaster.
I think anything with Patrick Moore was a roller coaster.
He never stuck to the script. Yes, this is definitely for astronomers.
And we hope that this would also be for all those girls listening who might just be inspired by what you've been saying to give science a second chance.
Thank you. Yes.
Well, Jocelyn Bell-Burnell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sibelius is at the Castle Gate, performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham, ending this edition of Private Passions. The producer was Elizabeth Burke, and the series is a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. And you might like to know that you can download the programme if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael Barclay will be talking to Adam Nicholson.
Wagner's Tannhäuser at the BBC Proms. Continuing this season's anniversary focus on the music of Richard Wagner, the tale of a troubadour who yearns for spiritual redemption, the woman who loves him, and the man who loves her. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and conductor Donald Runicles continue their acclaimed Wagner partnership at the BBC Proms. Tonight, from 6 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. Britain, the United States and the European Union say they have concerns about the elections in Zimbabwe, which have seen President Mugabe returned to office and his ZANU-PF party take a commanding majority in Parliament. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said there were irregularities before and during polling day. But the president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, has congratulated Robert Mugabe on his re-election. One of Scotland's most senior Catholics is expected to apologise on behalf of the church for 3 decades of physical and sexual abuse of pupils at a boarding school in the Highlands. The Bishop of Aberdeen, Hugh Gilbert, is to address the claims of abuse by monks at Fort Augustus Abbey. More than 20 US embassies and diplomatic missions across the Middle East and North Africa are closed today because of security concerns. The British embassy in Yemen has been shut until Tuesday, and the Foreign Office has advised against all travel to the country. The new Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, is due to be sworn in to office shortly. It's expected that he'll use the ceremony to unveil his first ministerial appointment, a US-educated economist, as his chief of staff. The swearing-in ceremony will be attended by a number of heads of states and representatives of dozens of countries. Police in Tunisia say they've shot dead a suspected Islamist and arrested at least 4 others in a raid on a house south of the capital, Tunis. The government, led by the moderate Islamist Ennahda movement, has been under pressure to act against Islamist extremists, whom it's blamed for the assassination of a prominent opposition politician last month. The Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, has called a general election for the 7th of September, 6 weeks after being returned to office. Mr Rudd ousted Julia Gillard in a leadership contest in June. His Labour Party faces a tough battle to remain in power. And the weather, rain and showers in the southwest of England and Wales will spread northeastwards through the day. Otherwise, it'll be fine and dry. BBC News and weather at 1:04. And time now for today's Early Music Show, which is the second of 2 programmes this weekend, celebrating the music of the English Renaissance composer John Dowland. It's introduced by Lucy Skeeping.
We're always keen on anniversaries on the Early Music Show. They help to focus the mind on a particular event or, as in today's programme, on a particular composer. And perhaps rarely has one man come to personify early music quite as much as John Dowland, whose 450th anniversary of his birth we're celebrating this weekend. Of course, Dowland's image in the popular imagination may be partly to do with the instrument he's so closely associated with. To many people, the classic Tudor minstrel is a fellow singing to a lute. And that's something John Dowland did better than just about anyone else. What's more, he perfectly reflected the fashion of the time, the cult of melancholy. It was no good giving a well-educated courtly audience some merry ditty. Lute songs needed to be mournful, and the more desperate or lovesick, the better.
If my complaints
Barbara Bonney, the singer there, and Jacob Herringman on the lute with If My Complaints by John Dowland. John Dowland was a complex character, a man who had an interesting and eventful life and who, like most musicians during this golden age of English music, depended on powerful patrons for his living. Like so much of the early repertoire, though, his music was virtually forgotten by the 19th century, only to be rediscovered in the first decade.